This is All In. I'm Lauren Chapman, filling in as host today. Today we're talking about Indiana's 2021 legislative session, which kicks off next month. To find out what we can expect, we talked to our statewide team of reporters here at Indiana Public Broadcasting in a Facebook Live event held last night.
Hello and welcome, Facebook. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman. Tonight, we've gathered our statewide team of reporters to discuss what lawmakers might tackle and what advocates and stakeholders are hoping for. So the entire team, health and science reporter Barbara Anguiano, State House reporter Brandon Smith, education reporter Jeannie Lindsay, workforce reporter Justin Hicks, energy and environment reporter Rebecca Thiel, and business reporter Samantha Horton. So let's go ahead and kick things off with Rebecca and Barbara. Rebecca, you covered the 21st Century Energy Policy Development Task Force meetings. There were two big things that were proposed during those meetings. The first was standardizing some things for renewable energy projects. So what are lawmakers looking for with that?
So if you are a renewable energy company, it can actually be kind of hard to build here in Indiana. Counties and townships, they all have different laws, like how far you can put a wind turbine from somebody's property line, or how much money a renewable company should pay in property taxes. And, you know, especially with something like a wind farm, that could mean multiple counties and multiple different rules. So having statewide standards would be really helpful for these companies. Of course, not everybody wants a wind turbine or a solar farm next to them. So we could see quite a bit of opposition to that.
And the second is a law to ensure reliable energy generation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That was something that was very important to the co-chair, Representative Ed Soliday. California has suffered some blackouts, and I think that especially has really scared him and some other members of the task force. You know, some say that's because they relied too much on renewable energy and not enough on some of these other sources that can be turned on and off, that are on all the time, I should say, like coal and natural gas plants. But other members of the task force say, we're not really quite sure why the blackouts happened. You know, that could have been because they rely on a lot of power from other states, or maybe grid operators just dropped the ball here. Whatever the case, 9 coal plants in Indiana are expected to shut down or partially shut down within the next decade. So lawmakers want to make sure that when that happens, we still have that reliability.
Now, you've done some reporting very recently, in fact, about how communities react to these kind of coal plant closures. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's, you know, for some of these communities that there aren't a lot of industries, having those shutdowns can be really devastating. You know, there aren't other industries to support those towns. One kind of unique coal plant is up in Michigan City, NIPSCO's coal plant. That's a little bit different situation. You know, it's in a more urban area. There are more industries, and it seems like they're ready to see it go. So, but I would say on the whole, a lot of these communities are really tied to those plants.
And that was something that you experienced when you did some of your reporting on the Petersburg coal plant and that shutdown. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. That's only going to be a partial shutdown. It's going to be 2 of 4 units that's going to close. But even so, Petersburg is really tied to that plant. There are industries there that are built up around that plant. It's going to be a pretty major loss to tax revenue, to jobs. So they're really going to have to figure out, how do we deal with that? And, you know, really the solution there, you know, get those other industries into the town.
Now, these are things that lawmakers are likely to tackle because these issues have been studied and discussed at length by lawmakers. But environmental groups have some additional things they'd like to see addressed. The Hoosier Environmental Council highlighted the need for maintaining the budget for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and the Department of Natural Resources.
That's right. The budget for these agencies has been going down for many years, and that's even while overall state spending has grown in some of those years. Folks at the Hoosier Environmental Council say we're seeing the consequences of that. You know, there's less oversight for hazardous waste cleanup, for example, fewer staff to make sure that public drinking water systems are safe. So that's a really big deal. And the HEC wants to make sure that we avoid any more cuts.
And they're also really concerned about net metering. Can you explain, first of all, what net metering is for folks who don't know or understand particularly?
Sure. So if you have solar panels on your home, you might generate more energy than what you actually use, and then it gets sent back to the grid, or AKA your neighbors. And for that, the utility pays you a certain amount of money for that extra energy. That's basically net metering.
So then why is the Hoosier Environmental Council concerned about that, especially leading into the legislative session?
Well, that's mainly because of a pretty big law that passed 3 years ago that said Hoosiers with solar panels are going to get a lower rate for that extra energy starting in 2022. Many environmentalists say that discourages people from getting solar panels because you're not getting as good of a return on your investment. And that's pretty important because while the price of solar has gone down, it's still pretty expensive and not affordable for many people. It's important to know that last year there was a bipartisan effort to overturn that net metering law, but I believe, if I remember correctly, it didn't get a hearing.
Yeah, that it ended up failing pretty early in the process. And so do you think that lawmakers are likely to take up this net metering legislation again?
You know, ordinarily, I think that it's definitely going to be taken up. Now, whether or not it's going to also fail like it did last year, it's harder to say. I think that it's interesting to see that Representative Ron Bacon, who is outgoing, so that's important to know, did show support for such a thing. But then again, there are so many other lawmakers that I'm sure don't feel that way. So it could possibly be more of a fight, but we'll just have to see.
A little bit more of a wait and see. Let's go ahead and move over to Barbara. This is your first legislative session, so how are you feeling about covering it?
A little nervous, not gonna lie. How much time do I have to tell you how I'm feeling about it? Because there's a lot of feelings.
So much time.
So a little nervous, but being so thrown into the whole COVID situation and kind of reporting on that nonstop, I kind of forget that there's a legislative side of things. So it'll be nice to go back in and sort of look at what's been going on behind the scenes and really be able to piece some more of the legislation that really affects everybody's day-to-day lives. So a little excited, honestly, to be able to switch subjects up.
Nice. So the Indiana Chamber has highlighted raising the state's tax on tobacco products. You've talked with other organizations that want the state to take action on the state's smoking rate.
Yes. So I recently spoke to the American Lung Society Association. And they recently put a report out ranking states as far as their lung cancer rates. And, you know, Indiana's numbers aren't great. So a big push for this legislative session from the group is to limit the use of tobacco products indoors. So they're looking at casinos, they're looking at bars. But they really are saying, you know, looking at the big picture, that's not enough. What needs to be done is really make tobacco products inaccessible. And the way that we can do that is through raising the price. You know, their data shows that Indiana has some of the lower cigarette prices in the area. So they're really eyeing that to sort of try to curb people continuing and B, really starting it all, because, you know, they've noted that you start when you're younger. And so if we make more expensive, what kind, you know, what young person can really afford, you know, however much cigarettes cost these days.
Even with the age raised, which seems like 100 years ago, but it was literally just federally, I think it was the beginning of last, oh, that was this year. That's a lot. you've already had some experience covering the conservative and liberal approaches to marijuana legalization and legislation. What are lawmakers proposing for this session?
So that's another hot topic, as far as Indiana being the only one of the only states in the area that hasn't really moved in any sort of direction as far as legalizing. I mean, we've got Michigan, we've got Illinois. And so when this all started back in 2017, that feels forever ago, 2016 maybe, the big push was a sort of medical stance for marijuana. And so at that time, the conservative side of the argument really was seeing it as a business opportunity for the state, and sort of more of this personal responsibility approach to, you know, you do you, for lack of a better phrase, and, you know, we can make some money while we, you know, other states are okay with it. Why can't we? So there have been some proposals from, I believe, Senator Talian, who is from up here in the region, and, you know, bordering Chicago, the sort of the impact that marijuana has had on marijuana sales have had on the city and the state of Illinois. Like, it's, you know, it's I don't want to say it's becoming a problem up here, but it's more prominent as we share that border. So her proposal is really to, you know, decriminalize small amounts of marijuana and really try to push the state forward into really easing those convictions. And, you know, the medical portion of it still stands, but it's really, it'll be interesting to see, mostly because the governor has such a strong no stance, even back in the days of just purely speaking medical marijuana.
Thank you both so much for hanging out with us. That is energy and environment reporter Rebecca Thiel and health reporter Barbara Anguiano.
You're listening to Conversations from a Facebook Live event held last night to preview the 2021 legislative session with reporters from Indiana Public Broadcasting. I'm Lauren Chapman, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Lauren Chapman. Today we're listening to conversations with our statewide team of reporters at Indiana Public Broadcasting, previewing the 2021 legislative session in Indiana, taken from a Facebook Live event held last night.
So now let's go ahead and move over to our education and workforce with Jeannie Lindsay and Justin Hicks. Justin, let's go ahead and kick things off with you. So first things first, what in the world is a workshare program, and who is pushing lawmakers to make that happen in Indiana?
Yeah, so workshare program is a little known, I'm not going to say rare, but it is a little known kind of program that you can do with unemployment insurance, where essentially the way we think of unemployment right now is you're either working or you're not, right? Like, you either have a job or you're laid off. And that obviously was particularly a big deal in the pandemic when a lot of people got laid off, right? But with a workshare program, what an employer can do is they can come in and say, hey, listen, we just don't have a lot of demand right now. Like, let's say that you are like making cars, right? And people weren't driving as much in the pandemic. So, you know, the car factory could say, like, we still need to make some cars, but not as many cars as we were. So we can tell everyone we're all just going to cut everyone's hours across the board by a certain percentage. So when that happens, then the unemployment insurance program could step in and then pay for the difference there, prorated, and then help people kind of keep their income, right, while working less hours effectively. So that's what the WorkShare program is. It is implemented in about 26 other states, maybe 27 now. Throughout the pandemic, the federal government tried to encourage states who didn't have WorkShare programs to think about those and maybe implement those. They've also given some money, or they've made some money available to states to even, you know, for the administrative costs of coding programs and setting up those things. But in Indiana, that just has not happened. So that is what a WorkShare program is.
And is there anybody in particular that's pushing for this kind of thing to happen at a state level, or is that more of a federal push?
A lot of folks actually on the state level here. So the Indiana Chamber is a really big supporter of it. The Indiana Institute for Working Families is also a large supporter of it. There's a lot of economists around the state as well who are strongly in favor of it. So honestly, I would say it is much easier to find people who are in favor of a WorkShare program than those who are against it. I guess, or maybe I should say, the people who are for the WorkShare program are much more vocal, I should say, maybe than the people who are against it.
Totally makes sense. So another thing that we've seen a lot at a federal level is talking about paid family leave. It's really been highlighted by the pandemic. Yeah. I know that Women for Change has pushed for better state level paid family leave. How would that impact Indiana?
Yes. I mean, in particular, I think paid family leave has been shown in particular, right, to positively impact women in the workforce, right? Because a lot of times when you think of paid family leave, you think of typically parents, right, who are maybe taking care of children, that kind of thing. And, you know, culturally, it doesn't have to be this way, right? But culturally, it winds up being that more women, you know, are kind of called in to leave the workforce in order to take care of kids when they're sick and that kind of thing. Or when you have kids who are young, right? Maybe under 1 year old. So with paid family leave, obviously, if we had a policy that said you have to offer paid family leave, that would make it so more people could take some a little bit of time off when there's emergencies in the family. And then, of course, that's not a policy, to my understanding, that just saying, you know, you just can't just take days off and go chill and watch Netflix at home. It is really something that you use sparingly when there's emergencies with your family.
So we actually just got a viewer question for Justin. Where do unions stand on this WorkShare program?
That's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure. I would think, though, I would imagine that unions would probably be mostly in favor of it. I mean, one of the big things about the WorkShare program, one of the big good things about it is that it increases the connection between the employee and the employer. And that's good for unions because let's say, like, again, let's go back to my example of you work at a car factory, right? You know, if you are continuing to work at that car factory for some length of time, you would still be a part of the union, probably, you know, the UAW, right? So I would think that unions would probably favor it because it increases the connection with the employer and therefore with the union. So I can only really see an upside there. And at the same time, too, it really supports workers in the sense that you get paid, you know, there's a lot of this potential to be paid more for even, you know, the less or maybe even same amount of work. So, you know, I would think unions would probably support it.
So last year, lawmakers gutted a pregnancy protections bill that subsequently died in the House. Do you anticipate that coming back this session?
I do, yeah. That bill has had the support of Holcomb in the last session. So that's a positive sign. And at the same time, I think it's come up for several years in a row now. So Women for Change definitely told me that that's something that they really wanted to see come back. And, you know, if you keep knocking on the door enough, hopefully eventually that door will open. So we'll see what happens there. And with that bill, essentially, it has been I think maybe that bill used to be a little, maybe it had more regulations involved. It has since been kind of watered down to the point. So it really just says in a very general way, you know, businesses should provide reasonable accommodations for pregnant workers. And that could include, like, you know, giving someone a stool to sit down on because you can't stand on your feet all day long, or, you know, couple other things. It doesn't necessarily mean, right, that you have to like provide a special room for breastfeeding or something like that. You know, this is not that far. This is sort of, you know, probably more watered down than even that. So it has a lot of support from a lot of folks. It just kind of keeps getting, I don't know, sidelined or ignored. So we'll see if this is a year for it. We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll certainly find out. Moving on to our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay. It's funny that we included you and Jeannie together because the workforce reporters ended up being like one part business, one part education. But moving on to Jeannie, there's nothing big happening in education this year, is there?
So funny. No, not at all. Why would there be?
Nothing at all. Of course, the big focus this year is going to be on funding, funding for teacher compensation, funding for virtual learning because of COVID-19, and overall school funding. So what are some of the main roadblocks to these issues?
Well, the first big roadblock that we've been hearing a lot of people talk about in the State House is obviously revenue that the state has to address those issues. Teacher compensation has been something that teachers have been talking about for years now. And 2021 was supposed to be kind of the big year where, you know, the state addresses that. And so the Teacher Compensation Commission came out with its recommendations. And but obviously COVID has thrown a wrench into all of that. And it's also made clear a lot of inequities in education, even more so than they were before. I mean, talking about education, we know that there are a lot of things about it that are inequitable. And the pandemic has just highlighted those even more dramatically. So the revenue shortage is going to be a challenge to address that. But also doing it equitably is going to be really important because the schools that have already been hit hard with a lack of funding are getting hit even harder with, you know, the resources that they have had to, you know, address the challenges exacerbated by COVID-19.
So earlier this week, of course, the Governor's Teacher Pay Commission announced its recommendations to increase teacher compensation. So what's the price tag on that? And what is the reaction from groups across the state?
Yeah, so the report uses data from 2018-2019, so it's actually old at this point because we're heading into 2021. But it says that in the 2018-19 school year, that $60,000 of an average teacher salary is what would make the state competitive among its neighbors and, you know, address a long time that, you know, teacher raises have not kept pace with inflation. And so they said $60,000, but that's a little bit higher now because, like I said, we're heading into 2021. And the price tag that the commission has included is about $600 million. And so it's included recommendations for schools to address, you know, different strategies that they can reallocate dollars, come up with new revenue, things like that. But a lot of it is going to be reliant on the state because, as we know, the state took on the responsibility of fully funding education a long time ago with the property tax caps. And so, you know, that has had a ripple effect for a very long time. And this report, the education groups that I've talked to, the teachers unions, the school boards association, they say that it's kind of confirmed a lot of what they've been saying for a really long time now. I talked to Terry Spradlin from the School Boards Association today, and he said that this is a timely report, especially with the session almost upon us, but it's also going to be a useful tool to see, you know, to show schools, you know, what they can and could be doing to help, you know, address the problem, but also, you know, highlighting what responsibility and roles that lawmakers, the General Assembly has to address this issue that has just been kind of snowballing for quite some time now. So, yeah.
And of course, you talked to school financial managers a few weeks ago about how this session could really make or break their budgets. What have you heard from them, and what have you heard from lawmakers about overall school funding?
Yeah, so a big problem for schools is the CARES Act funding was not quite equitable in terms of its distribution. So some schools and school corporations got a boatload of money, while others did not. And they, you know, are still dealing with very similar things. So that shortage has caused some of them to dip into their, you know, rainy day funds and things like that. So really the addressing the fully funding of schools and, you know, keeping up with inflation, if lawmakers can do that at all, is going to be a huge deal for them. You know, but also right now people are kind of, the phrase cautiously optimistic has come up. So people, like, especially in schools, they want as much money as they can get because of all of the essential needs, again, exacerbated by the pandemic. But they're also, you know, saying, you know, even just avoiding cuts would be great. And lawmakers have kind of said similar stuff. I mean, today, the revenue forecast, one of the budget leaders, Senator Ryan Mishler, he said that, you know, it's probably going to be a flat line this year. And that's not music to anybody's ears, but it's definitely a huge relief when he also followed that up with, there likely won't be cuts. And that's kind of been the boogeyman that's keeping school financial people up at night, is the idea that they could lose funding this year when the CARES Act did not do everything that people said or kind of hoped that it would. And then combined with, you know, trying to address this teacher compensation question and enhancing equity among different types of schools. So, so even just keeping it where it is now would be, I mean, better than cutting it.
Totally makes sense. And of course, to continue the theme of disparities, virtual learning also became a little more complicated because of COVID-19 and a law that was passed during last year's session, which ended the same week as Indiana reported its first case. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so virtual schooling has an interesting recent years in Indiana, just wrought with problems. And so all of the issues that were happening with virtual schools and regulations and virtual learning, lawmakers really tried to address that. But part of addressing that was limiting the amount of funding that they would send to schools, because that's been really tricky and a big problem. I did some reporting on that that people can read up on if they would like. But lawmakers made this law that would restrict funding because it sends money to schools per student. That's a huge chunk of the funding. And so this law that they passed would restrict virtual funding, funding for students who are learning virtually more than half the time. So instead of getting that whole 100% chunk, they'd only get 85% of it. And so that law just kicked in. And then COVID happened and everybody went virtual. So that's been a huge concern. And I don't know how worried people really were about it. But then this fall, when schools were debating how to open, and, you know, there were a lot of political folks and a lot of elected leaders talking about what they thought schools should do and how they think that they should have reopened their buildings this fall. One of our leaders here in Indiana sent a letter to schools basically warning them that they could face cuts if they don't have, you know, an in-person option. And that's a huge deal, because a lot of schools have most, if not all, of their kids learning remotely at some point. So I've talked to some school folks about that, and I mean, the amount that schools would lose if they don't get full funding for their kids that are learning virtually full time, it's millions of dollars. There are districts that have whole, like, all of their kids learning remotely, learning virtually. And so it could absolutely destroy their budgets if lawmakers decide, you know, not to fully fund schools. You know, legislative leaders, a lot of them have said that they are committed to fully funding schools and they'd like to do that. But that letter that was sent from Senate Republicans wasn't sent for no reason. And that has a lot of people freaked out. And so, you know, there's a lot of, again, cautious optimism that people will, and the General Assembly will, address this and not shortchange schools for operating the best way that they can while this pandemic continues.
And of course, you're keeping an eye out on a handful of other education issues, or just keeping an eye out on education issues in general. Is there anything else that might creep up that kind of, what's your dark horse thing that might come up during the legislative session that you're like, oh, this would be funky and interesting?
Well, people in schools have been talking a lot about standardized testing, and that'll take some action from the federal level, waivers from the U.S. Department of Ed. It'll be interesting to see if lawmakers decide to do anything. When the state transitioned to iLearn, the new test, they, held them harmless. And then obviously iLearn did not happen this last year. So I'd be interested to see if they do anything about standardized testing, because that is something that I've been hearing from schools, that they are not really sure how to do that, especially with the pandemic. There's light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines, but that's not going to fix everything, before March and before those testing windows open. So I'll be curious to see if they do anything about that. The other thing, too, that I've been hearing a lot about, part of the virtual learning question is broadband and Wi-Fi. So that's going to be a huge thing. And school leaders have made a point to talk to me about that every time I talk to them about what they're hoping for from the legislative session. So seeing how the General Assembly addresses all of that, and anything that people haven't already talked about, anything that pops up randomly, we'll see.
It should be an interesting one, to be sure. Yeah. And of course, we'll hear a little bit more about broadband when we talk to our business reporter, Samantha Horton. But right now, that was Justin Hicks, Indiana Public Broadcasting workforce reporter, and the lovely Jeannie Lindsay, our education reporter. Thank you both so much for joining us.
You are listening to conversations from a Facebook Live event held last night to preview the 2021 legislative session with reporters from Indiana Public Broadcasting. I'm Lauren Chapman, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Lauren Chapman. Today, we're listening to conversations with our statewide team of reporters at Indiana Public Broadcasting, previewing the 2021 legislative session in Indiana, taken from a Facebook Live event held last night.
And last but certainly not least, we are talking with our business reporter, Samantha Horton, and our State House reporter, Brandon Smith. Sam, let's go ahead and start with you. Last year, there were two payday lending bills that died at the end of the session. Do we expect to see one or both of those come back?
That's a great question, Lauren. And I know it's been an effort for a couple of years, or not even a couple, probably more than I've just been covering it for 2 years. But it's been an effort, really, that the Indiana Institute for Working Families has really pushed and lobbied that there be caps on these payday lenders. And I mean, to give you a reference point, right now we're looking at, they've had about roughly, typically they're about, I have to pull up the numbers here really fast to make sure I get this right. But typically, I mean, we're looking at median incomes on these payday loans are usually about $19,000 per year. So these are lower income people who are needing money to get by. Maybe it's, a car broke down, something like that. But the flip side of that is the payday lenders don't have to follow standard caps on the interest rates. So you're looking at a 391% annual percentage rate when you're talking about the interest rate on those, which is incredibly high. And that just leaves a lot of people going into debt and they can't necessarily pay that back. And so, I mean, the ask has been to try to put a cap at 36% to make it more reasonable. I mean, it's really kind of a thing where there's has been going back and forth between on the other side of this argument. Some argue that small businesses maybe need a small little loan to help them start their thing and they can pay it back. And on the flip side, you look at where these are located, and a lot of them are usually located in low income areas. So there's a big discussion point there of, well, if they're really meant for everyone, why are they located in areas targeting low income? So there's a lot of discussion here. I think COVID-19 has also brought a really big challenge for a lot of people financially. So I have no doubt that there'll be something of this nature coming back into the session. I don't know where it will end up. I mean, it'll hopefully, you would think a lot of people would hope that it would get a committee hearing. I mean, that has been the past 2 years, it has, and it has made it out of committee in the past, but it's died, at least in 2019. The bill that would have put a cap on it did die. And last year, there was a bill that did pass, like you referenced, actually, but it didn't really do exactly what some were hoping with really putting restrictions on this. So it didn't really have the teeth that I think some were wanting. So I think we're going to see something of some form. I'm not sure what that'll look like. So we'll see once bills start being introduced.
And of course, COVID also really highlighted the divide between rural and urban access to broadband. So what are folks hoping will be done to expand rural broadband?
Yeah, so this is a big push right now the Indiana Farm Bureau is doing. I typically cover what their legislative priorities are, and last year was healthcare. This year it is broadband for 2021. I mean, you look at it, I mean, thousands of Hoosiers, and Jeannie alluded to it earlier too, thousands of Hoosiers don't have access to internet one, possibly, internet that's reliable is another option, or they're paying a really high fee to have access to internet. So there's kind of a multitude of things that are happening that, you know, people in rural areas just, it's known as a digital divide, and COVID has really proven that to be even more challenging. So because you think of telehealth, you think of education, as Eugenie mentioned, and you think of, you know, for agriculture, a lot of stuff is becoming very technology driven. So there's a lot of data that goes into ag and so much more that maybe people don't necessarily think of right away, but it's really being modified. And the problem is when you don't have that reliable system in place or affordable necessarily, it's really creates this challenge for these communities. And groups are having to figure out how do I make sure my kid can get, you know, online to go to school today, or, you know, for doctor's visits for COVID, especially when hospitals aren't really wanting people to come in person necessarily, getting those visits. So I know the Indiana Farm Bureau, they've pushed this before, but this is their priority. I'm not sure. The state has put dollars towards broadband. To be fair, they have, and local communities, the federal level has as well. But the reality is it's been, my perspective at least, pretty slow to see the progress. At least we still have people who don't have this, and this is not a problem that just started in 2020. So I think I know for a fact that with the Indiana Farm Bureau pushing this, there's going to be something there. And I mean, the relationship they have with legislators is pretty strong, that they feel confident that, you know, they hope that something will get passed. And so that's pretty much what we'll see there.
And of course, you know, speaking of COVID and the way that it's changing things ahead of Org Day, I know Brandon did some reporting on liability protections being a big topic for the legislative session. You're looking at it. What are business groups saying about state level protections?
Yeah, absolutely, Lauren. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned state, because there is a federal conversation right now, which could play an impact on what we see at the state level as well. I've talked to the small business advocacy group here a lot about this. This has been a conversation pretty much early on since COVID started, concerns about, you know, the liability for a business on not just their employers, but also customers and other things. Like, where do we draw the line? Like, if we are providing the personal protection equipment, if we're doing this, like, how far, where can we essentially protect what they're representing, the small business owners. So, I mean, there is this fine line that's going to have to be figured out and navigated, because, I mean, while there is a vaccine out there, it's still not everyone's going to get vaccinated at any time in like the near future. And this also, I think, will set a precedent going into the future. I don't think anyone thought a pandemic was going to happen in 2020. So I think this liability stuff could also come into play in future references. So it's really important, honestly, I think, because it's not just trying to understand, you know, workers' rights, so to speak, and business rights, but it's also then, you know, how does this, you know, play out for others in the future? If we have another virus or pandemic, you know, what's the protection? So I think the thing is we'll see what happens on the federal level. That it has happened before, where policies that they're drafting a federal, sometimes the state will be like, that's good enough, we'll go with that, and kind of not necessarily push as hard in Indiana. And based off of at least right now, what we see is I would be shocked if that would happen. But I mean, something will definitely be introduced on this as well.
Brandon, we'll go over to you. This year is going to be weird, right? It's hard enough to get bills not budget related passed during a budget year. What can we anticipate this year?
I have absolutely no idea. This will be my 11th session, and I'm struggling to accurately predict what's going to happen. And a lot of that is driven by the pandemic, and not just because of the issues that we'll see in legislation because of the pandemic, but literally the physical act of holding a legislative session while we are still in the middle of a global pandemic, particularly as you have some lawmakers who clearly do not care about keeping other people safe, because they're great like that. So, for instance, on a very basic level, the Indiana House of Representatives will not meet in the House chamber this session. They have moved across the street, essentially, to Government Center South. Committee hearings will be held there. But when you are testifying, if you wanted to testify in a committee hearing this year, you won't be doing it in the same room as the lawmakers. They will be separating out testimony in different rooms. There's also the matter of how they get everything done. They are going to put a few more limits on the number of bills that some lawmakers can offer. They usually do that in short sessions, but in long sessions, it's a lot, typically a lot more wide open. And this is a long session, a budget writing session that we're coming into. But they're going to put some greater bill restrictions, so you won't see the same number of bills authored. And committee chairs have been getting the messages out to their members that we are not going to be able to hear as many bills as we normally do. So really, like, focus in very tightly on what you want to get done. And all of that planning, some of which has been very robust, some of which, quite frankly, has not been up to this point, at least not in a public way. All of that is also thrown out by the fact that what happens if a bunch of people get sick? There is no plan in place for what happens. How many people would need to get COVID, for instance, for them to temporarily shut down? What happens if key committee chairs get sick? That sort of thing. We don't have answers for any of this. They don't have answers for any of this. So literally how you have a legislative session that's 4 months long is an unknown, which is a very weird situation to be in going into a legislative session.
Especially a legislative session like this, because the state also has to redraw legislative and congressional districts. So can you illuminate what that process looks like? Not specifically for me, but I guess also, but specifically for me. And are lawmakers expecting delays because of ongoing U.S. Census fights, you know, all of that?
Yeah, so on top of it being a budget session, which is normally a little chaotic, and on top of it being a session in the middle of a global pandemic, that will make it both harder to have the session and also creates a lot more issues that lawmakers will feel more compelled to address than usual. You also have something that they have no choice but to do, which is redraw the legislative district lines that always comes a year after the census is conducted. So that's done, for the most part, like a normal bill process. They'll craft these maps, which are put into legislative form. They are very, very long and have all these little numbers and letters to, you know, sort of notarize the districts. But they'll present these maps. They will seek, legislative leaders have said they want it to be a very public process. So they want to seek public input. How you do that in the middle of a pandemic when testimony is harder is going to be tricky. And then they'll pass them through the General Assembly like any other piece of legislation. But you did mention we are looking at the potential for delay. So the U.S. Census Bureau, which conducts the census nationwide, sends information to the states at different times. They don't send the whole thing all at once. Some of it goes right away, for instance, so you know how many congressional seats each state is going to have. It's unlikely Indiana's will change. We currently have 9. We will probably remain at 9. If anything, we will lose a seat. There's no way we're gaining one. But then beyond that, they have to usually in like, I think it's like March, but don't hold me to that. The states usually get the specific information they need to redraw those district lines, because districts have to be drawn a certain way in terms of how they're apportioned by population and things like that. But with legal battles that the Census Bureau is involved in, there's been talk that they might not be able to get the information to the states as early as they normally do. If that's the case, now you're looking at, do they need to come back for a special session to redraw the maps? Do they come back later in the year to redraw the maps? So all of that is, again, these things that we just normally know and this year do not.
And then, of course, we have the added hink in the hose of some more conservative members of the Republican Party have criticized Governor Eric Holcomb's use of executive orders to navigate the COVID-19 pandemic. I know that Ball State had a study recently that talked about, you know, how many folks would be interested or believe that his powers should be limited. Do you expect that will come up in this year's session?
I do. And it's maybe one of the things I'm most interested in seeing how it plays out in the 2021 session, in part because I don't really have a good sense for where it's going to land. And it pits Republican Governor Eric Holcomb against Republican supermajorities in the House and the Senate. Yeah, as you mentioned in your question, there are not a small number of Republicans in the legislature who are really unhappy with the governor and the way he's approached the pandemic. As I sort of alluded to at the top when I started, some of it comes from folks who don't believe that the pandemic is a big deal and don't think that the government should be restricting anything related to the pandemic. They don't believe in requiring people to wear masks. Some of them don't believe in wearing masks, period. They don't believe in asking businesses to change anything about how they conduct business in the middle of a pandemic, or certainly that the government should have any role in that. And they've been really critical of the governor doing anything. Some of them perhaps don't go quite that far, but do think that the legislature has been sidelined in this process. Now, of course, the legislature was not in session really during the pandemic. They could have been called into special session. It is the governor who does that. And Governor Holcomb has said that he checked in with legislative leaders throughout the process to say, hey, do you want to come into a special session to address these issues? And he described there being no appetite for that. I can tell you that's not true of a lot of members. That may be true of legislative leaders, perhaps in their wisdom. But what I think you might see is some sort of legislation that, while not taking away the governor's emergency powers, injecting the General Assembly more into that process. So something like these executive orders and these public health emergencies that the governor continues to renew, they are statutorily only allowed to go for 30 days at a time. And then he has to renew them. There's some thought that legislation could come up wherein if he wants to renew them more than twice, so say more than 3 months under an emergency order, the legislature would have to, for instance, if they objected to it, they would have to be brought into special session to take the proactive step to stop it, as opposed to having to come in to approve something, which would have been very, very difficult to do during, for instance, this particular pandemic, to gather 150 people in Indianapolis. Something like that is less restrictive, certainly, of the governor's power. But there's also the question of how that will affect the orders that he's already given. Are they prepared and do they want to take away his authority right now? I suspect some of them do. Whether enough of them do and the legislative leaders allow that to move forward is, to me, one of the most interesting and unanswered questions of the 2021 session.
Well, thank you so much. Brandon Smith is our State House reporter and Samantha Horton is our business reporter. Thank you both so much. And thank you to the fine folks who tuned in on our Facebook for this conversation ahead of the 2021 legislative session. We have actually put together a resource guide to make things a little bit easier for you and should be able to find that link in the comments. It includes an adventure game in which you choose your fate, but is in no way related to the highly litigious book series I built Doing Too Much Math last year as a principal guide for this session. If you'd like to keep up with us, feel free to join our texting group, the Indiana Two-Way, by texting Indiana to 73224. We are answering your questions about state policy, the response to COVID-19, vaccines, and just so much more in our weekly text messages based off of the responses that we received from not only that texting group, but also from our embedded questions in the stories that all of these reporters do on the daily basis. I put together an FAQ this week on vaccines based on questions that we received from you.
You've been listening to conversations from a Facebook Live event held last night to preview the 2021 legislative session with reporters from Indiana Public Broadcasting. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you like a podcast of this show or any past shows, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And just a quick note, we'll be running repeat shows for a few weeks, starting tomorrow while we search for a new host. We'll be back with new shows starting in January. happy holidays. And as always, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Lauren Chapman. Thanks for listening. This is All In.